In 1980, funding for space exploration was losing its priority in the United States budget. Carl Sagan, Louis Friedman, and Bruce Murray founded the Planetary Society to advocate for the continued exploration of the solar system. The Society's mission is to communicate to the public and enlist our support for projects that NASA and international space agencies are engaging as humanity explores our solar system. Emily Lakdawala is a geologist and is the senior editor and planetary evangelist for the Society. She writes a regular blog on which she reviews the status, events, and happenings of the missions of spacecraft and rovers throughout the solar system. In this episode of EconoCast, Greg, Layton, and I will be talking to Emily mostly about the Mars rover, Curiosity, how the engineers and the scientists at the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena map out the plans for the SOL, which is Martian Day, how they decide where the rover should go next, how they programmed it to take the best selfie ever, and why these photographs make sense from a scientific standpoint. We will also talk about the Dawn mission, which has just recently arrived at Ceres after having observed the asteroid Vesta. So it's the first time ever that a craft has accomplished a mission like this one. Emily Lakdawala is our guest for this episode, so please listen, and then go to support the Planetary Society's mission to advocate for more exploration of the solar system. Greg and Emily, welcome to IconoCast.
Emily, welcome to the show, and thanks for taking the time to join us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
I think I would like to just get right into it, because this is what the stuff you write about and are involved in is some of the, I think, most interesting stuff you can do in science. It's also the farthest away from anything that I ever got to do myself, so that's maybe why I find it so interesting. But you know, you basically are engaged in writing about and interpreting for everybody what they're doing out there with these space robots that do science, right?
That's right.
And I was wondering if you could just start out by giving us a basic accounting of what it is that happens in a given normal day driving around the Curiosity rover and collecting data. I mean, how does that work? What does it look like, and what are the challenges of doing a normal operation with a Curiosity rover on Mars?
It's a very challenging operation, and I've sat in on Curiosity mission operations a couple of times, and I have to say that having done that, my overwhelming impression is just how exhausting the whole process is. Mm-hmm. So basically, it begins in the simplest version that happens right after the rover landed. They were operating on Mars time, and so they were operating on Earth on a calendar that matched Mars clock. And Mars days are similar in length to Earth days. They're slightly longer, about 40 minutes longer. So the planning day begins when the rover sends to Earth images and other data that it took after it finished whatever its day's operations were on Mars. And a downlink team looks at all of that data and says, assesses the images and makes sure the rover is safe and happy and that the temperature is being controlled well and the computer is operating as it should and all of those kinds of details. And once they've determined that it's safe to plan for that day, they pass along that word to the science and tactical team, and they get started doing their planning. Now, there's several different things you can do with a rover. You can stay put and take lots of photos and other science data. You can drive the rover. You can do arm operations. In general, on Curiosity, they have a sense of what kind of sol it's going to be a couple days in advance. And so they usually know already, this is going to be a drive sol, this is going to be an imaging sol, that kind of thing. And so there are a couple of different science theme groups. There's a geology theme group and there's an environment theme group who sort of work in parallel to figure out what kinds of observations or activities they want to do that day. They begin to get their plans together. Then they all meet up and talk about, okay, we want to image this place. We want to reach out with the arm and do this thing. They're communicating with engineers about how much resources it's going to take, how much energy, how much space all of the data is going to occupy in the rover's memory. And they keep track of other things, that consumables for everyday rover health. And then once that plan is approved, they go away, they put more detail into their plans, they deliver it all to an engineer who assembles it. And there's another meeting where they go through the whole sequence step by every step, make sure that everything is going to be safe for the rover, that it won't go over its battery power, all that kind of stuff. And then there's another process where they finalize the plan, and finally they deliver the plan to the database from which the Deep Space Network gets the plan, uplinks it to the rover on Mars. The rover begins its day, and all of this stuff happens all over again. And it's just day after day. Originally at landing, it took like 16 hours to get through this process. Now it takes them about 9. So it's getting more streamlined, but it's still a very long day.
Wow. I'd imagined it took time, but I had no idea it was going to take 9 hours. But yeah. From what you just described, it does sound like it would take 9 hours. So what would be an example of, you talk about being safe, what would be an example of an unsafe thing that you might?
An example of something that might not go quite right is if the rover is, say, driving or something, and it detected an unsafe condition. And it doesn't mean that the rover has actually, that nothing unsafe has actually happened to the rover. It's just the rover has detected that something could go bad if it kept going in the direction it was going. So there might be a tilt limit on how much its legs are allowed to tilt as it drives over obstacles, or there might be a temperature limit, or there might be a limit on how hard the motors are allowed to work. And if one of those limits gets tripped, the rover will halt all of its activities and then send a little beep, a bit of information back to Earth saying, hey, I stopped early. There's something wrong. And so the team would have to assess that. Is this something where, oh, the limit was just too conservative, we can set a higher limit and let it proceed the next fall? Or are we actually getting into a situation that we find hazardous, and so we need to change our plans?
Yeah, I noticed there was something recently where the rover was trying to take pictures of some sand up really close. And it could only get focus at a certain distance, but the arm also couldn't move the camera beyond a certain distance, or it would break the camera. And there was a lot of apparently discussion about how had to be worked out between the scientists want the close up and the engineers want to not break it.
Yeah, that's the general tension on the mission, is a tension that's in between the scientists and the engineers. You know, the scientists always are trying to push the spacecraft to its limits, to make the most of it, to get closer, to drive faster, to gather more data, and the engineers are always trying to protect the rover's health. Although that's, as with all kinds of splits, that's too simplistic. I mean, the scientists, of course, they want to protect their rover, and the engineers love it when they can get as much science data as possible. But with that particular example of the arm imaging, they have limits. You know, you do not want to press the camera onto sand. That would be very bad for the camera. You don't want to, actually what they're really worried about is the rover not understanding where the arm is with respect to the sand, and the rover being told to put the arm at a position that's actually below the surface and driving the arm against the surface of Mars. That would be super bad. So they operate with all kinds of safety limits and margins that say, okay, we are not going to command the arm to get closer than a couple of centimeters of the surface, because that way, if we've made a small mistake, the arm will still be safe. And so that thing that I blogged about with the up-close imaging was a careful negotiation between the scientists and the arm operators about, well, can we make that margin just a little bit tighter so that we can get just a little bit closer to the surface and get just a little higher resolution images? And so that was a complex negotiation between the scientists pushing the limits and the engineers working with them, but always trying to preserve the health and safety of the rover.
Emily, would that be a situation then, too, where they're planning on something like that, that they would actually run the simulation here on Earth before they'd actually send that up to Mars?
Oh, absolutely. If they ever do anything new with the arm in particular, they always run it in a test bed on Earth. They have a physical, nearly exact copy of the rover, its mobility system, its computers, its arm, its mast, and the instruments are not necessarily perfect copies, but the mechanical parts of the rover are. And so if they're ever being asked to do something unusual with the rover, they will do it on Earth first.
How different is the actual landscape, or how surprising is the actual landscape in relation to what you assume it is before driving somewhere? I mean, there must be pretty good detailed photographs from above, but how often does the rover or any rover run into a rock that wasn't supposed to be there, or a terrain that's too rugged or slopy or something like that?
Well, with the benefit of the high-rise camera on Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, we have really good reconnaissance of what the landing site looks like. And so for things like regional topography, you know, topography on the scale of the rover or larger, we have really excellent from orbit. Mm-hmm. When it comes to the small-scale texture, we didn't really have a good sense of what that was going to look like before the rover landed. But now that we've been there for 1,300 sols or whatever number it is today, I forgot to check, there's the science science team in particular is getting better and better at, from experience, at predicting what a terrain is going to look like based upon its appearance in the orbital photos. So there are subtle things about the color and the texture of the terrain, as you can see it in the orbital images, that give the scientists clues about, okay, this one's going to be a smooth terrain, this one's going to be flagstone-like, this one's going to be strangely eroded, you know, and now the scientists have a really good sense of what the terrains will look like.
So that's a process going on in human brains, human learning.
And, absolutely.
And a lot of this is, you know, obviously it's not a robot that's acting independently like R2-D2, it's humans running a very complicated machine. How is there a hope that in future rovers that they can be smarter themselves and actually be able to make decisions that have to now be cycled through this long multi-hour process with the time delay and have them just be able to handle themselves more independently?
That's definitely something they're working towards. So they began actually with the Mars Exploration Rover, Spirit and Opportunity, to increase the autonomy of these rovers. So initially, you might imagine driving a robot on Mars as being kind of like a very simple, I don't know, logo type programming. I don't know if kids still do logo these days, but you know, drive forward 10 wheel rotations, then turn left 90 degrees, then drive forward 20 wheel rotations. You know, you can imagine, and that's called blind driving. That's where the rover has no idea what it's driving into. It's just running the commanded number of wheel rotations that it received in instructions from Earth. But then there's various levels of artificial intelligence that they've begun to add into the rovers. They've added something called visual odometry, where the rover looks to the side with its navigational cameras as it's driving and can autonomously track features that show up in the images as they go past the rover. And so what that allows the rover to do is to estimate how far it has actually traveled, not just count wheel rotations. And that's important because on a rough surface or a surface with sand, the wheels slip a little bit. And so you never travel quite as far as the number of wheel rotations you've commanded. But with visual odometry, you can get a very good estimate on board the rover of how far it really traveled. And then they've added other capability that allow it to actually navigate to certain points that it can see in the landscape based upon its 3D sense of the landscape built up from image data. And so what that actually allows is that you can tell the rover simply to drive to a point, and it will make decisions as it drives along about whether the direction it's headed appears to be safe, and if not, it will attempt to navigate around any hazards. And Mars Exploration Rovers really did a lot of this. Curiosity got started doing it, but unfortunately they weren't really able to continue doing this autonomous navigation because of the wheel wear problems that they encountered. So Curiosity hasn't been using it very much. But one thing they have added on Curiosity is, or they're working on adding it right now, is a kind of autonomous imaging target selection. So if the rover drives a long drive stall, can be up to 100 meters in a day, and you might imagine there would be interesting rocks that they passed by that then they might regret that, oh, you know, we saw that unusual dark rock and we didn't take any pictures of it. Too bad, it's too far back. And so they have this autonomous target selection software they're working on called Aegis that allows the rover to autonomously pick targets in the middle of drives to take science data on. It also helps them target the ChemCam imager to autonomously pick science targets to take photos of so that they don't have to do all of that in the science planning meetings, and that can help them shorten their science planning day.
I guess a key point here is that it takes a lot of energy. It must take a lot of energy to send the images back, and there must be limits on, I mean, if you think about your cell phone, you can take as many pictures as you want with your cell phone, never really fill it up, and you don't have to worry about these things. But imagine if you're on Mars with this machine, you have to actually limit the total amount of data you collect in a day and be more selective.
For sure. Every single spacecraft anywhere in the solar system, the missions are mostly bandwidth limited. So you're limited on the amount of science data you can get just by the narrow pipeline that you have connecting the spacecraft with Earth. And Curiosity uplinks all of its data through either Mars Odyssey or Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter right now, and then it comes from one of those two orbiters down to straight down to Earth. And they can get upwards of a gigabit per day on really good days, but it's usually not that good. And so, and that's data that's shared among not only all the science instruments, but also all that health and safety data that the rover needs in order to let the engineers know that the rover is safe. And that alone takes like 70 megabits a day. It's not insignificant. they always have to decide very carefully how much data can we take, how much will it be compressed, how long will it take to get all that data down. And in fact, they're careful, they're very careful to take more data than they can possibly hope of returning to Earth, because that way, if they ever have some kind of pause in scientific activities, as sometimes happens if they have some kind of anomaly, then they can always fill up every single downlink with lots more data from Mars. It's just lower priority data that's been sitting around on the rover for a while.
Oh, I see. Yeah, so it can hold more than it can. What operating system does the rover use?
It runs on something called VxWorks, and that's about all I know about it.
Okay, I've heard of it, yeah. It's always interesting to know what... It doesn't run Windows.
It does not run Windows or Linux.
I'm sure VxWorks is much more like Linux than it is like Windows. So one of the things that Curiosity does now and then is it takes selfies.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that the multi-billion-dollar project and all this bandwidth limitation wasn't set up just for taking a fun selfie. Can you tell us why it takes selfies and how... what we learned from that?
Well, originally, the idea of taking a self-portrait with the robotic arm was just a kind of, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we could do this? And you're right. Originally, it wasn't the kind of thing that you would regard as being a high priority at all. But when they, of course, they do these activities first on Earth before they try anything new with the arm on Mars. And so they took a self-portrait of the rover on Earth. And when the engineers saw that and imagined what it would look like when they got it on Mars, and suddenly the rest of the team got a lot more excited about it. Because, you know, we're all humans. Seeing the hardware that we built sitting there on the surface of another planet is just totally thrilling. And these missions are for science, but they also have a very important public education, public inspiration, outreach role. And there's always a certain amount of rover activity. There's always a certain amount of activity in all science missions that is directed toward public engagement. And this was certainly one of those things. But now, since the first time they took the photo, I think the Molly team leader, the guy who's in charge of that camera, said he expected it to happen once and then never happen again. But what the team has gotten into the habit of taking one of these self-portraits at every major sample site, because probably more than half of the science results of the mission are going to come from the very small number of sites where they actually drill into the ground and get samples. And so they see these self-portraits as a part of the documentation process of being at a sample site. They've already invested weeks and weeks of time at that sample site getting set up and getting ready to drill and putting all the samples inside the analytical laboratory instruments. And so in the grand scheme of things, it's not actually that much more data to take this kind of self-portrait and send it back to Earth as a way of kind of capping off the campaign that they've done. They've spent weeks doing at each of those sample sites.
Well, yeah, actually, if you do archaeology, which I've done a lot of, or any of a number of other field activities, it's normal and expected and highly unusual to not take pictures, your contact shots of the equipment, the people, the large scale. You know, mm-hmm. You always have a few shots like that. And they're not just, you don't just take them. When you actually write up your report, you include them. You know,
that's right.
It is part of the documentation of what you're doing.
And there's a high proportion of publications that have to do with Curiosity Science are going to include one of those self-portraits on the cover, because it really does stand for the whole mission. And you can see the effects that the rover is, you can see the rover itself, and you can see the effects that the rover has had on the surface. Those self-portraits also contain the drill holes and other things that show the evidence of the rover's interaction with the surface.
So no one can say that you were making this whole thing up, which they will say. Somebody will say that.
Well, of course, but for people who say that, I doubt they'll be convinced by a self-portrait image.
That's true. You know, in anthropology, there's actually this famous anthropologist named Claude Lévi-Strauss who wrote a book called Tris Tropiques, which I actually read when I was working in the Congo with F.A. Pygmies. And he wrote about his work in Brazil in the 1940s with Indians in a certain area. And he lamented the fact that in those days he had no technology to record things, but he was doing interviews. On the other hand, if he had waited 30 years to get recorders, the Indians wouldn't have been there because that area had been turned into plantations and they were all gone. And I remember thinking about that for myself because my research involved mapping things in, and I had to use a transit and tapes and pacing things. And if I went and did all the research that I did over about a 3-year period, did all the mapping today with a GPS machine, it would take me a month or two. But the Congo War would have happened and other things would have changed and I wouldn't have been able to do the research anyway. It must be a lot like that with space robots. If it takes a couple years between the time you finalize your technology and get a robot on Mars. That doesn't sound like very much time, but in the last 3 years, probably you're describing to me things that that Curiosity does that I can also do at home with my six-year-old using an Arduino and a bunch of parts we can buy from Amazon and looking up stuff and make. Like, we could build a robot that can identify things that look different and take a picture of them. Now, of course, it wouldn't be as sophisticated, and it would probably break all the time, and it wouldn't be as good. But it must be true that a lot of technologies that are available right now were not available or as small or efficient or as fast or as reliable or as sophisticated as they were when the spaceship originally launched.
That's true. There's a lot of things that make it harder to implement these things on another planet. One of them is that they have to be able to survive the rigors of launch, which is a huge amount of G-forces and vibration, which is just horrific on most commercial off-the-shelf stuff. So you have to have something that's much more robust to the kind of vigors that it encounters just at launch. And then once you get to Mars, you have these daily temperature cycles of 80 degrees Celsius. And that thermal cycling is just terrible on electronics, basically busts them apart really rapidly. And so the kinds of conditions that these things encounter mean that there's not a lot of off-the-shelf stuff that you can just fly to Mars. Another thing that's extremely complicated is the fault protection that these rovers have. You know, most of the software is not the software that is used to make it go places. Most of the software is to prevent the rover from dying, because once it's dead, you can't do anything about it. You can't send AAA up there to, you know, jump start the battery and let it keep going. The rover has to never, ever fail. The amount of reliability that's required to make a spacecraft continue to operate for 15 years straight, that's what Mars Odyssey has been doing, without any ability to go up there and fix something that broke, without being allowed to make a single mistake that could lead to the spacecraft not talking to you anymore. That's just a huge burden. And so, yeah, you can imagine all kinds of things. And I'm sure that the engineers at JPL see every new capability popping up in the commercial market and say, aha, let's see if we can maybe use this kind of thing on Mars in the future. But there's only some of them that can be made robust enough to be able to deal with the rigors and risks of space travel.
You know, everybody plays now with their Raspberry Pis. It's a very common, you know, hobby computer. In fact, you can make a reasonable desktop computer with it. And I think that didn't they just come do something with, I think, the International Space Station? There's a shield. A shield is they might have a different word for it for a Pi. But it's a bunch of circuits you stick on another controller or computer that's got a lot of stuff built into it. And there's a shield that is being used in space to collect a lot of data, and you can get the same exact shield in for your own Raspberry Pi at home. Now, they're using Raspberry Pi. I of course, the International Space Station is not the same, because, first of all, if it doesn't work, they can just throw it out. And there's a person there who can reboot it, so it's not anything like it. But there is actually a way that people can get the same technology they're using for these projects. It's a way of involving citizen scientists and interested people in the project.
That's just right. But keep in mind that in order to launch something to the space station, it has to go up on something that is safe for a human to ride in and to experience. So you're talking about environmental conditions that are way, way more benign than you have on a deep space exploration. The other thing about there's some really promising stuff going on with things like Raspberry Pi and using an iPhone to run a CubeSat and things like that, where you can get away with doing stuff with miniature components close to Earth for a couple of reasons. One, it's just much cheaper to launch stuff close to Earth. It's much easier to communicate with it. But two, if you can make them with very cheap components, you can launch a lot of them, and then you can tolerate several of them not working. And so rather than building a single $2.5 billion Mars rover, you would launch, you know, 30 micro rovers to the moon, and maybe only half of them would survive landing, but you'd still have 15 rovers on the moon, and wouldn't that be cool?
Have you seen the documentary Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control?
I have not.
You should try to see it sometime. It discusses that idea. There's a rocket scientist guy on it, who discusses the idea of sending, you know, 30 spaceships instead of one, and you hope half of them work. But they also talk about topiary, and they link that concept in. They talk about animal training, and they link that concept in. And they talk about naked mole rats, and they link that concept in. I'm not going to attempt to explain how it all links together and makes sense. It makes sense to about 1/4 of the people who watched the documentary. I used to show it in class and ask people to explain what they saw, and about 1 in 4 students make the links. But it talks about that. That's the idea of fast, cheap, and out of control. NASA has leaned in that direction, hasn't it, in some ways?
NASA sometimes uses making multiple copies of a spacecraft in order to reduce risk, sometimes not. You know, in fact, that's why there are 2 Mars exploration rovers, because the NASA management looked at the project and said, you know what, you can't guarantee that this thing is going to work with enough certainty, so build 2, and that way you can be reasonably confident that one of them at least is going to work. But still, it's not the kind of mass production that I think these forward thinkers are talking about. You really can't envision that for Mars yet. I think the first thing to do is to do, like what I said, micro rovers on the moon, or a network of little observatories in Earth orbit, or like a little seismic network on the moon would be terrific, although it's actually really hard to land a sensitive seismometer without breaking it. So that's it's a difficult right. problem.
You don't land a seismometer. You land a bunch of things that then self-assemble as a seismic. I've always thought that the concept of sending a group of people to the Earth and bringing them back safely is an interesting idea. You're probably familiar with Biosphere. It was a controversial project that the idea was to put people in this big terrarium and have them survive there without contact with the outside world ecologically. So they all their air and food and everything and nutrients would be recycled internally. And in part to study how those systems work, and actually a lot of knowledge was gained from that, and in part to figure out as a concept, test of concept, to put something like that on another planet or just in a giant space station, that sort of thing. And they actually, interesting, weren't able to do it that successfully, but you could make all these giant robots, it seems, or tiny robots in large numbers to do something like handle an oil spill in a offshore environment, or you know, collect lots of data on chimpanzee activity in the rainforest or something like that as a way of advancing. Well, you describe it yourself. When Curiosity started, it was many, many, many hours of interaction for every stall of planning, and that went down to 9 hours. That's not because the machine changed or the planet changed, it's because the humans got good at it. You know, so I was just wondering if that would be something that to try that kind of thing on Earth first, in a way.
I know JPL has some project where they're working on cooperative robots, because you know there's a whole another kind of programming technology that you need in order to teach robots how to work together. So that's a separate engineering problem.
Also, just since I'm just a person who knows not what I'm talking about, but I'm making suggestions anyway, mm-hmm. Why not have another vehicle up there, like a tow truck? You know, something that has a solar collector and a battery and can just push the rover when it gets stuck, or take a picture of it to show us what's wrong with it when it's, you know, a trailing support vehicle.
You got another $2 billion in your pocket?
That's
for your tow truck?
It's totally worth it.
I would rather send a copy of Curiosity to another science location on Mars than to have a tow truck for Curiosity.
That's true. I'm working with the money is no object base, it's a space line. But.
And launch a lot of Curiosities. Actually, right. No, launch a lot of Spirit opportunities.
Yeah. Well, so, okay, what do we now know about Mars? What are the really interesting, most important things that we now know about Mars that we didn't know before the first rover science?
Well, the last couple of decades have seen a real renaissance in our understanding of Martian history. And we sort of began with this post-Viking view that Mars is kind of like, it's sort of moonish in that it's heavily cratered and geologically dead. There is a sign of water activity in the past with the valley networks. But Mars was dead. It was interesting, but dead. And then with the newer missions, we've gotten a much more nuanced view of the length of Mars's geologic history, as well as the interesting things that are happening on Mars today. In terms of Mars's geologic history, we've learned that Mars had a very different character in the most ancient past than it does today. But it wasn't just unidirectional. So it wasn't just a matter of it was warm and wet and then it became cold and dry. It's actually more complicated than that. It had this early history where it was being bombarded a lot. And there's signs of water activity across the surface at some times of this early history. But the water activity really peaked at about somewhere around 4 to 3.8 billion years ago, at a time when also there was a lot of volcanic activity and the impact activity was beginning to wane. The other thing that we've noticed about Mars's history is that the kinds of minerals that Mars makes have changed with time. So in the modern era, we have a really oxidizing environment. Any kind of material that's at the surface is going to be oxidized by things like hydrogen peroxide and perchlorate. It oxidizes all the minerals, turns reduced iron, sort of dark iron, to rusty red iron. If there's any organic material at the surface, it breaks it apart instantly. Organics just don't survive in the environment of Mars today. If you look a little further in the past, though, it wasn't quite the same. The landscape that Spirit and Opportunity rovers have looked at show a Mars that had some water, had a lot of volcanic activity, and the water tended to be very acid, very acidic. It deposited things like gypsum and the kinds of materials you see in like Yellowstone, sort of volcanic fumarole environments. But even further in the past, you get a different kind of mineral again, and that's clay minerals. And clay minerals require a lot of water, and they also require the water not to be so acidic. They require a more neutral pH. So if you look in Mars's most ancient rocks, you can see this evidence that there was a period when there was a more happy Earth-like environment. It may not have been exactly like Earth. I think the evidence is still strong that Mars was always pretty arid and that whatever water activity there was limited in both time and place. There were environments that were a lot more kind to Earth-type microbes. And so if you want to look for a time on Mars when there may have been life, you really need to look in those most ancient rocks. And that's what Curiosity was sent to Mars to do, was to study the kinds of environments that existed during this time when it was a more clement environment. Curiosity is not a life detection mission. It's not designed to look for either modern or past microbial life, but it's designed to study those ancient environments so that we can learn a little bit more about how they may have worked.
Yeah, that's interesting. What about the atmosphere and how it's changed over time?
Oh, yes. We've had a number of lines of evidence that have suggested that Mars has lost a lot of its atmosphere over time. And both Curiosity and the MAVEN mission recently have studied the atmosphere from below and above and come to a pretty similar conclusion that Mars has lost more than 90% of the atmosphere it ever had. And you can do that by studying the isotopes of, I think it's oxygen isotopes present in the atmosphere. And if you find a lot of heavier oxygen, that lets you know that the lighter oxygen has escaped out of the top of the atmosphere. That's how Curiosity has done it. MAVEN is looking at modern atmospheric escape rates and kind of extrapolating that into the past. And one of the interesting things that MAVEN has found is that the escape rate, it varies a lot depending on solar activity. And so you have a very active sun shooting a lot of storms. A lot of the atmospheric loss happens in these kinds of more random, it's not constant. It happens as there are more solar storms.
And Mars doesn't have quite the magnetosphere that Earth does, so it's not as well protected as our atmosphere is, from what I understand.
Yeah, it doesn't at present. It probably did once, but that was a long time ago. It was back in this earliest part of the history. Now, for me, it's an interesting question. When did the internal dynamo shut down? When did Mars lose its magnetic field? And that may have been right around the time that the chemistry changed from that more clay-like environment to that more acid-type environment. There's a lot of really interesting things that were all happening at roughly the same time, but we're still talking about within, 200 to 400 million years, which is a lot of time. Mm-hmm. And so you can't really say that all of these things are contemporaneous. They're all in an interesting part of Mars's history, and that's the part of Mars's history that it's really worth exploring.
And you're a geologist, so it's a lot of fun for you to look at, correct?
Yeah, it's all very fun.
Yeah, I was wondering about the magnetosphere, because that would have reduced the effects of the sun on the atmosphere and kept the atmosphere more in place. And you're saying that would have been quite early.
Yes.
Now, does this mean that Mars is small, and the magnetosphere may be facilitated by a slightly larger or more internally heated up molten planet, and the magnetosphere is important? So are we saying then that within the range of roughly Earth-like planets, that being too small is a limit on whether or not you can have a long period of a billion years of Earth-like conditions?
Yeah, it might be. I mean, there's a lot of different things that enter into that problem. I mean, Venus also doesn't have much of a magnetic field, but it's got problems for life for other reasons. And so Mars is a little on the small side for life to have hung around for a long time. It's lost a lot of its internal heat. It doesn't have that much geologic activity anymore. It does still, by the way, have a molten outer core. We did figure that out from, I forget which mission, but I'm pretty sure that the consensus is now that Mars is not solid. It's right. Got a molten outer core just as Earth does, and probably Venus.
And so if we could figure out why Mars's magnetosphere has done what it has done in relation to the Earth. We'll know a lot more about how that works in general. Also, just on the life thing, it's worth noting that the origin of life, there's no evidence at all that the origin of life on Earth took a long time. It's there, and it doesn't change much for a long time, but there's no reason to say that it didn't happen quickly in geological time. And then the origin of multi-celled life, or the time period from having only single-celled life to having something much more complex, is actually very short, geologically speaking. Something was stopping that from happening, and the conditions weren't right or something like that. And it all happened very quickly. So having a few hundred million years of conditions amenable to life is actually enough time to go from nothing to multicelled organisms.
I'm not sure about your history there. I think that the multicellular change happened way later than the origin of life on Earth.
Yes, it happened way later, but much later. It happened over 3 billion years later,
right?
Or about 3 billion years later. But in that time in between, there was nothing happening. It isn't like you had to be unicellular and unchanging for a billion or 2 or 3 billion years before you could become multicellular. There were conditions, something happened to cause that to occur, and there's no, I know of no reason to say that that time period had to be that long, and it couldn't have been compressed.
The fact that it took that long for it to happen could mean that it's a very low probability event. Most of the scientists who are looking for life elsewhere in the solar system are not they're not banking on finding multicellular life. They want to find life of any kind, and microbial life is just as good as multicellular life. So you might as well focus on that.
Yeah, well, we really want to find sentient beings and talk to them.
That may be you. I think that the scientists who are interested in exobiology are realistic about the fact that if life is common, it's probably most common as microbial. You know, you better be looking small because you're right. Evidence suggests that it originated on Earth about as soon as life could possibly originate on Earth. And multicellular life came much later. And so I think that if you ask a room full of scientists if they think that there is multicellular life elsewhere or ever has been multicellular life elsewhere in the solar system, not a lot of them will say yes, but if you ask them if there has been microbial life elsewhere in the solar system, I think you'd find a lot more scientists guessing that yes, that has existed in the past and maybe even today.
Can you tell us a bit about Mars 2020?
Sure. So Mars 2020, it was intended to be a build-to-print copy of the Curiosity rover with a different set of science instruments and a different mission, actually. So Curiosity was sent to study ancient habitable environments on Mars, this mission that I told you about of trying to look at this most ancient period of Mars's history and understand what the environments were like that could have supported Mars life. Mars 2020 is really the first of what would have to be 2 to 3 missions in Mars sample return. So Mars 2020 is designed to drive around Mars, document sites, and drill and store samples of different kinds of Mars rock in a canister that could be picked up in the future and brought back to Earth. So instead of the complicated analytical laboratory instruments that Curiosity has, the 2020 rover has in that same space a sample handling and caching mechanism.
Mm-hmm. And then how will they get back to Earth?
To be determined. There are some, they wouldn't be doing this if they didn't have ideas for how that would work, but NASA has not yet committed to a mission that would actually gather these samples. And I've been talking with the science head of this mission, Ken Farley, and he actually feels it would be a little premature to actually even start, build that spacecraft until you knew that your sample gathering had worked. You don't want to waste the money on a retrieval mission if you wind up crashing your gathering mission on Mars and never gathering any samples. So it's a patient course waiting, but they're obviously have some ideas about how that would work in order to design the sample caching system that they have. Presumably they'd be landing close to the site of the sample caches, they'd have a small rover that could retrieve the samples, bring them back to the location of the lander, where they would be loaded into some kind of rocket that would launch it into Mars orbit. And then a third mission would rendezvous with the thing in orbit and bring it back to Earth.
Okay. You write it on your blog on Planetary Society, you write about quite a few other missions that are out there in the solar system. And one of the ones that was fascinating to me has been with the Dawn project and how it had gone out to Vesta, and then after it had recorded a lot of data there, then it went over to it took another excursion over to Ceres and started mm-hmm. recording data from there. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what we're learning about Ceres, especially the way that they were able to look at the geology and kind of about a low number of craters and determine what might be going on inside of Ceres itself.
Well, Dawn, like you said, is a mission to explore two different asteroids, and it has the distinction of being the first spacecraft to orbit, go into orbit around two different solar system worlds beyond Earth. And they're two very different worlds. Vesta is a very rocky, dense asteroid. It's not a metal asteroid. It's a rocky asteroid. And it's probably the source of about 25% of the meteorites that we have on Earth, the stony meteorites. They're called the HED meteorites. Ceres is located a lot farther from the sun than Vesta is. It's about twice the diameter. And because it's so much farther from the sun, it condensed a bunch of lighter materials than Vesta did when it formed. And so Ceres is made of roughly half water ice mixed in with the rock. And one of the interesting results that's coming out of the Dawn mission is an understanding of how the rock and the ice are put together. Usually when you imagine what the interior of a world looks like, you think like Earth, you know, we have a rocky crust and a rocky mantle and a metal core. Vesta also has a rocky mantle and a metal core. So you think about things layering in terms of their density. And so I always imagine Ceres as having a water mantle, a water ice mantle, and then maybe an inner layer of rock, and then maybe an innermost layer of some metal. But what we're seeing about the shapes of the craters on the surface and the kind of topography that you see on Ceres, there's a lot of steep scarps, and there are craters that still have pretty steep walls. And water ice, even though it's very cold, it's not a very strong material. You can't, at least not at the asteroid belt's distance from the sun, you can't build really steep mountains out of water ice. They just collapse mm-hmm. under their own weight, just like glaciers flow downhill on Earth. They're solid ice, but they're just not strong enough to hold up those steep slopes, and they just flow downhill. And the same thing would happen with ice on Ceres. And so the fact that you've got these steep crater walls tells you that it's not pure ice that Ceres is made out of. The ice that it's made of, which has to be a pretty large fraction of the composition of this outermost layer anyway, it's mixed with quite a lot of rock. And so they've determined that it has to be a pretty intimate mixture of roughly 35-40% water ice with the rest rock in order for it to be able to hold up these steep crater walls. And that's very different from what we imagined about the inside of Ceres before Dawn got there. And so that's been, for me, that's been one of the most interesting results.
I think it's kind of fascinating, too, just because of the fact that it is so large for an asteroid that it's actually hydrostatic in its mm-hmm. created a sphere because its gravity is strong enough to do it. And being a dwarf planet that's closer to us than Pluto, the fact that we're able to actually stay in orbit rather than kind of shoot by it like New Horizons, is, I think that's been pretty much a fascinating project that they've been working on out there.
Yeah, the fact that they're able to go into orbit around it has as much to do with its location in the solar system as anything else. Because it's in the main belt, it's still, relatively speaking, close to Earth. And so it's not as big a modification of the orbit around the sun to go into orbit around Ceres as it would be to go into orbit around Pluto. We could go into orbit around Pluto with the technology that we have today, but it would take a long time mm-hmm. to match the orbit of your spacecraft to the orbit of Pluto. It would take decades, the way we do things now. And so it's just really hard to do that. Now, we could study something that's a lot like Pluto, and it would be a lot easier to enter orbit there because there's a really big planet located next door. And so that's Triton, the moon of Neptune. And so if we sent an orbiter to Neptune, It's way easier to go into orbit around Neptune than it is to go into orbit around Pluto, because Neptune is so big. It's got more gravity. It's easier to gather a spacecraft into orbit around it. And then once you're there with your spacecraft, you get to study an ice giant, which is Neptune, and you get to study a captured Kuiper Belt object, which is Triton, and that would be a really interesting mission.
We should do that.
We should. I agree.
Emily, are you working on a book?
I am working on a book.
Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, sure. It's called Curiosity Rover, Design Planning and Field Geology on Mars, which is a long academic title for an academic book. It's designed to be a resource for space fans, and also I want to teach the geologists about how the rover works, and I want to teach the engineers on the mission what science they're learning, because Curiosity is such a complicated mission. There's really no one person who understands everything about how the rover works or has really been able to keep up with all the science that it's doing. And it's really funny for me always to talk with Curiosity engineers who are thrilled to learn about the science that their machine is doing. And then I talk to scientists who are surprised to discover things they didn't know about how the rover worked. And so this book is for all of those people.
Yeah, that's actually what I really love about your blog, because you kind of do that on your blog. You connect the two sides of the operation, the engineering and the science, and then make it understandable using great graphics and so on, many of which you make yourself, you know, to the average person. I think that, well, not the average, to interested citizens
That's a distinction that I like to draw. I write for the interested public. I write for people who want a little more than you can get from, say, a NASA website. And NASA does a great job of communicating to the public about what they do with their missions. But because they have a mandate to communicate with the broad public, they don't always get away with providing as much detail as some of us would like to learn. And so I write for the people who are very interested and want to learn more. But you don't have to have a science degree or an engineering degree in order to understand what I write. I write for doctors and plumbers and you know, hairstylists. Some of my best conversations about space are with my Uber drivers and the person who used to color my hair. She had a telescope. She loved to look at the stars and was constantly pummeling me with questions about the planets. And I always really enjoyed those conversations.
Do you want to say anything about the role of the Planetary Society?
The Planetary Society was founded in 1980. By Carl Sagan, Bruce Murray, and Lou Friedman. It was founded at a time when public interest in space exploration was at an all-time high. The Vikings had just landed on Mars and returned these first images from the Martian surface. The Voyagers had traveled past Jupiter and Saturn and brought us these amazing close-up images of all of those moons. And yet both the executive and legislative branches seemed to be determined to end NASA at that point. Oh, we did some cool stuff. We're done. Let's turn the money to other uses. And so the Planetary Society was founded to provide a channel through which the voice of the public could be heard in Washington to encourage our government to continue what we had started with our exploration of the solar system. And we continue to do that today. We educate the public about space exploration. We advocate for more space exploration. And we do technology development projects in order to help along new ways of doing space exploration.
And you've grown internationally as well. I noticed that you have associates in Australia, in Asia, and in Europe to work with like ESA and a lot of different governments to promote space exploration.
Yeah, that's right. Space exploration is terrific. It's multi-partisan and it's super international. You go to any space meeting, and there are people from all over the world. I've used one of those map trackers on my blog and found that about 40% of my readers are not in the USA.
Wow.
And so it's really international. And, yes, the Planetary Society is an international organization. We focus and report on all of the space exploration activities of all nations. Our advocacy at present is mostly focused on the United States because that's where most of the dollars are. But we're very interested in advocating where we can for other governments to continue expanding into solar system exploration. And we're very pleased to see not only ESA and JAXA, which have been around for a while, but now we see India is orbiting Mars and China has a rover and lander on the moon, and the UAE is actually developing their first Mars mission.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's almost like a satellite or a spacecraft being jettisoned by the gravity of some giant planet to get it to go faster and farther. That the whole space exploration enterprise was jettisoned into the future by this international competition, the U.S. versus the Soviet Union and all that, and like in a space race. And now it's completely different. There isn't any evidence I see anywhere of people being nationalistic about any of their space work.
Well, the truth is that there's enough space for everybody. There's, and pun intended, but there's just so much out there that there's no reason to compete, and there's every reason to cooperate. So my grad school advisor was a guy named Jim Head, who's at Brown University, who started doing planetary geology by training Apollo astronauts in what different rock types were. And when, at the height of the Cold War, he developed a partnership with a guy named Sasha Basilevsky in Russia. And, you know, at the time, tensions between the U.S. and Russia were very high. The Russians had a bunch of successful Venus missions, but had had little success at Mars. The United States had had a bunch of Mars missions, but weren't able to do much at Venus. And so Jim and Sasha got together and worked kind of on scientific channels, avoiding diplomatic channels, and managed to exchange data. United States provided them with some Mars data, and they the Russians brought over Venus data, and there was this wonderful collaboration that was happening even when tensions were very high between our two countries. Nowadays, nearly every spacecraft has a highly international component. There are international co-investigators. Often there are foreign contributed instruments, and this is true of all space agencies around the world. And so it really ties all our countries together and manages to be fairly nonpartisan. The one exception to that is China, which is doing some really interesting things in near Earth orbit with human spaceflight, just about ready to launch the first sample return mission to the moon since the 1970s. And the United States is forbidden from collaborating with them for diplomatic reasons. And so that's one of the sour notes that's going on right now. But the Chinese are still collaborating with Europeans and other countries. And so for the most part, it's very international and not nationalistic.
What is the diplomatic reason that we can't cooperate with China?
There are Congress people who do not allow people who work for the federal government to communicate with Chinese researchers. And so that's put a lot of tensions, made a lot of people very nervous about working with the Chinese at all.
Well, we'll have to fix that. Can the average person or the average person who's maybe a technology geek and has some gear get the data from Curiosity directly? From the satellite that sends it back from Mars?
It's not possible to get the data directly from the downlink. I think that you need a 34-meter antenna to do that.
Okay, that's what I was wondering.
Yeah.
You need one of those big, giant antennas, and most people don't. I know some people in my neighborhood who have pretty big antennas for their TVs, but they're not that big.
I do know people who are able to monitor for signals from distant spacecraft, but usually they're detecting the carrier, and they're certainly not decoding the frames or anything. However, all of the data that the rover and all other space missions return is eventually made public, and sometimes it's made public pretty quickly. So for Curiosity, the images that it takes with all of its cameras are made public in JPEG format practically instantly. So you can get those on the web right away. And then all of the other kinds of data are archived to the planetary data system within about 9 months on average. And so you can log in and get data from every single science instrument. You can get some of the engineering information. You can get information on the rover's path across the surface of Mars. So in answer to your question, you can't intercept it, but you can still get it eventually.
Emily, thanks very much for your time. This has been a great interview. Now we know a lot more about Mars and space robots than we ever knew. It turns out that scientists on Mars have discovered a lot more than just dirt. We'll have links on iconocast.com to Emily's blog, to the Planetary Society site, and other resources related to today's interview.